The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, unlocking a genetic mystery, scientists studying an unusual jellyfish have determined the animal to have multiple genetic lineages. A new report examines the adolescent literacy gap, and we'll visit a new museum dedicated to all things pinball. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Portuguese man-o-war is an unusual creature, and for the last century or so, its genetics were largely mysterious. Now researchers have confirmed what was suggested by early naturalists, that the animals that float in seas around the world have genetically distinct lineages. To learn more, I spoke with Dr. Samuel Church, an evolutionary biologist at Yale University.
It sort of defies description in many ways. So it is a kind of jellyfish. It's a relative of the other jellyfish that we typically know. But it's unique because it has this gas-filled float that it uses to stay near the surface of the ocean. So they're found on the surface, and they, on top of that float, have this crest, a sail, that they can actually raise and lower that allows them to work with the wind to move along the surface. And then below, they have this often large curtain of tentacles that extend sometimes meters into the ocean. They use to catch fish. They're fish eaters. And the combination of this curtain of blue tentacles, often this beautiful pink crest, makes them these strikingly beautiful animals. But the tentacles, you know, are designed to catch fish. They've got a potent sting. And that's what I think really draws a lot of attention to them, is this idea that they're kind of a dangerous, if you have an allergic reaction, potentially deadly animal. And we find them a lot of times places we want to be as well. The wind has pushed them near shore or onto the beach. And so then we're encountering this, you know, blue, gas-filled, big tentacled thing on the beach and thinking, what is this? What am I looking at here?
So because they travel with this sail and it floats on the surface of the water and the wind pushes them around, is that why they're found all over the place, all over the world, is because they sort of move where the wind goes?
In part, yeah. So we have a couple things to consider here. The first is that there's not a lot of animals that truly sail, right? That use the wind to power themselves. So that makes them unique. And it also lends them what we think of as like this really big dispersal capacity. So animals are often trying to disperse, and plants too, right? To spread to somewhere else from where they were born or where they, in this case, surfaced. And these animals, we think, can do that. With the wind, can push things a long way, as we know a lot about how the wind moves particles around the ocean. But there's another component, which is that the open ocean is this really unique environment, and it's been studied and is now getting a lot more attention, which it really deserves, but in part because it has few of these big physical barriers, right? There's no big mountain range or canyon. And so animals that live in the open ocean or at the ocean surface can potentially have these really long ranges, these really huge populations. And for a long time, it was kind of thought that things out there are kind of everywhere. And this is in part what we're studying in this case, right?
Sure. And so your team set out to actually take a look at the genetics of the Portuguese man of war. And tell me a little bit about what you found. I had not known that there were more than one species, although I don't really know a lot about the Portuguese man of war. I just sort of assumed, well, it's an unusual animal and it floats around the world, so it's all got to be one species, but that's not necessarily the case.
So that's what we found in our study. So previous to this study, the status quo is that there was one type of man-o-war, or if you live in the Pacific and you're an English-speaking person, you might call them a blue bottle, one type of blue bottle or man-o-war for the whole world. And they really do wash up on beaches on every continent and nearly every part of every continent, right? You can find them in a lot of places. So there was this idea that it was one global cosmopolitan organism with this incredible dispersal capacity. And this idea had been around for about 100 years. But previous to that, there had actually been this really robust debate. So in the early days of taxonomy, like Carl Linnaeus and things like that, there were a lot of folks sailing on these tall ships around the world, observing these man-o-warp and thinking they look kind of different in different places. Sometimes I find small ones, big ones, pink ones, purple ones. And so there'd actually originally been dozens of species proposed. And as this larger understanding of their biology and of the ocean came forward, those ideas had been sort of squashed. And it came to be that there was a status quo. We think there's one man-o-war for the whole world. We don't have good evidence to believe there's been more than one. But we knew of this debate, and it was our goal to try and bring some of those questions to the modern era by applying tools and technologies that we have at our fingertips, which is things like genomic sequencing. So what we set out to do was collect man-o-war from around the world using this big international team of collectors, sequence their genomes, compare them to each other, and test whether it seemed more likely that these animals really represent one big population or multiple species that don't seem to mix frequently.
So how many species did your team actually identify?
So we find good evidence for, we think, at least four, and there's potentially more out there. We find a lot of genetic diversity, both across and within species. That's one of the most exciting things to us, is that even though they live at the open ocean, even though they have this big dispersal capacity, there seems to be a lot of structure in their population, meaning barriers that maybe we don't perceive that keep populations from mixing. And in our case, we think at least four of those species that we found that are genetically distinct from each other, we can identify then really clear characters like color or size or tentacle number that we can associate with those genetic groupings.
And that was going to be my question, is what's preventing these species, these different flavors of Portuguese man of war from mixing and creating a hybrid species? Is there evidence that this does happen?
We didn't see any evidence of what we would might call a hybrid in our study. But there's two things to consider here. The first is that there's this really striking genetic separation across species that we find. And that's interesting because the different species, they have distinct but overlapping ranges. So we found some places in the world that you might be able to collect two or even three species of blue bottles or man-o-war from the beach, even around the same time of year, maybe at different times of year, which means they have contact. They could potentially breed with each other because they're in the same location. So something's keeping them apart, and we don't know what that is yet. It could be an ecological or environmental separation. There might be some genetic incompatibilities that prevent them from creating viable hybrids. But then there's a second layer, which is this second layer of structure I mentioned. Within each species, there's these really strong signatures of regional subpopulations. An example I would give is we can really easily identify from the genomes East Atlantic versus West Atlantic Portuguese man-o-war. So the ones in Ireland are more similar to those in Spain and the Azores. And then the ones in Florida, New England, and Texas are more similar to each other. That level of structure we really think is associated with currents and winds, meaning that the animals are sailing, but their populations are largely defined by these current systems that exist, like the Gulf Stream on the Western Atlantic.
And just for a little bit of background, how does a Portuguese man-o-war actually reproduce? Do they just release their sex cells into the open ocean? How does it actually happen?
Yeah, if only it were that simple. We are still trying to understand a lot about their biology. But what I can say is these animals grow in a really interesting way. So instead of being, like a Medusa jellyfish with a bell and tentacles, these actually operate a little bit more like a head of coral. And they're kind of upside down. So if you took a head of coral and flipped it upside down in the water, and what I mean by that is they have many bodies attached to the float, and those bodies are clonal. I mean, they're descended from asexual reproduction. And then the way they reproduce, meaning make a new colony, a new kind of head here, is they create many bodies which are specialized for reproduction. So these would be like reproductive bodies. They make kind of a ball of them, and then they release that ball into the ocean. And what happens after that, we still don't know. So these little balls of sperm or egg producing bodies sink somewhere. We don't know where they sink to, but sometime after sinking, they presumably release their sperm, release their eggs, and those things find each other. And then when that happens, the next thing we see is new colonies floating back up to the surface as they start producing gas.
Huh, how about that? So the gas, there's another good point. The gas that actually fills the sail, the float of these animals, that's actually produced by the organism itself, huh?
Yeah, they make it themselves. They've got a gas-producing gland, and they just start, from little baby man-o-war, they start filling that bubble up, and they can really get a lot of positive pressure in there. It's pretty inflated.
Now, just going back to what you had said earlier about how scientists in the 18th and 19th centuries had made guesses that there were multiple species of this animal out there as they observed them in the ocean, and then that idea sort of fell out of fashion for a little while, and now the genetic testing is revealing that there is a separation of species in these animals. What does that just tell you about sort of the nature of science and the progression of science? And have you reflected on that point at all during your research?
Definitely. This is probably, I think, my favorite result or finding from this study was the opportunity to sort of vindicate some of these early drawings of man-o-war as really excellent descriptions of regional species. So there's a couple things about the history of science here. The first is that the folks that were making these early descriptions were doing it in really difficult circumstances, right? So these are famous expeditions like the La Perouse expedition, where they sail really around the world. And the drawings that are produced from that are these hand drawings that somebody's trying to make of an animal that, from the side of their ship, trying to observe that animal as best they can. It's a difficult animal to collect. It stings, it's, delicate. It probably doesn't lend itself well to catching with a net or things like that. So, it's these really hard-won drawings, and the people on that expedition ended up dying. The ship is lost. The drawing was preserved because they handed it off to somebody in East Asia who then walked it over to Europe. That's why we have that drawing today. So it's this incredible story of people, trying as hard as they can to describe this thing in early days. But then their drawings had to be examined and understood in the context of people working, far away from those animals. And trying to make sense of, is this a really a different species? Do we understand the biology? And at that time, we really didn't have a good grasp of, how these things grow, what we're looking at, what even is it a jellyfish? Is it a snail? Is it something else? And so those drawings, in some ways, were rejected as sometimes implausible, maybe inaccurate. This doesn't look like things we see in the Atlantic. Well, of course it doesn't. It's a Pacific animal. So there were some good reasons that these scientific illustrations weren't considered plausible, but the end result was that even though folks had gone, all around the world to find them, maybe their findings weren't being appreciated in the moment. What we have today is a totally different situation. We have this incredible resource like iNaturalist of thousands and thousands of people all around the world taking real-time photos of the animals and posting them online. And that's what we used in our study to evaluate, what the animals look like, whether they look the same or different in different parts of the world. So this is perspective that these 1700, 1800 scientists could never have imagined, just being able to see thousands and thousands of animals, almost simultaneously. And with that data in hand, we really could confirm that their drawings were very accurate, that they'd done a great job at capturing really interesting variation that was local to, let's say the Central Pacific or Western Australia or other places, postures, colors, things that aren't typical to the Atlantic, and so they weren't appreciated in their time.
So, Samuel, where will your research take you next? And is this an animal that you will continue to discover and research?
Yeah, so I will be starting a new position as an assistant professor at NYU this fall, and I'll continue working on evolution and biodiversity and genomics in a number of organisms, hopefully in Physalia as well. That's the genus name for this man-o-war species. But more broadly, I think what's exciting about this study is we really got together an international team. So there's many, many people that collected specimens for this study, and they did it from more than a dozen countries. And what I feel excited about for the man-o-war and for everybody is that I think there's going to be a lot of really exciting work to come out of a lot of labs in the near future. So I know people in Japan that are interested in looking at diversity there, people in Australia who are studying their distribution, the way they sail, the physical oceanography aspect. people in other countries that are looking into their toxins, their ecology, what they eat, how they sting. I think there's going to be a lot of new and exciting findings around this.
Dr. Samuel Church is an evolutionary biologist at Yale. His research is published in Current Biology. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. While state and education leaders routinely focus on boosting childhood literacy rates, a new report says middle and high school students are often overlooked. EdTrust New York's new report titled Every Grade Counts, The State of Adolescent Literacy in New York, argues for more public investment in helping teens improve literacy. To learn more, I spoke with Deputy Director of EdTrust New York, Jeff Smink.
In New York and across the country, we have been looking at literacy for the last several years, but really focusing on the early years and making sure that students can read by the end of third grade, which is a key point in learning. But very little attention has been placed on the needs of middle and high school students who also struggle with reading. And we know, because in New York we have huge issues in the way that we teach literacy, that many of our middle and high school students were never taught how to read. And so that has huge implications for students, obviously, for schools, for communities. And it's really a hidden crisis that impacts everything from, community outcomes like poverty, employment, and public safety, and certainly students, right, whether we're looking at graduation rates, attendance. And one of the things that we talk about in the report that is really overlooked is students' social-emotional needs, right? And imagine being an eighth or ninth grader that was never taught to read and what that feels like in school. The feeling of isolation and shame and not being able to participate. And that really impacts, whether or not students want to attend school, stay in school, all those things. So it's one of those foundational issues that, again, impacts everything from a student to an entire community, and in New York's case, an entire state.
So looking at the numbers from 2024 that are in the report, what can you tell me about adolescent literacy in particular? What does the data show at current?
Yeah, the data is really concerning. We look at really two key metrics. One is the federal NAEP, or National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is often called the nation's report card. And what we found in looking at the most recent NAEP scores were that 35% of all New York students scored below basic, which is the lowest level you can score on NAEP, and indicates that students lack even partial mastery of the key skills needed to read. If we look at the state, the New York State assessments, nearly half of all eighth graders were not proficient in reading, and significantly lower rates for our students of color, students from low-income backgrounds. And if we look at some of the big five districts, less than 25% of our eighth graders in districts like Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse were proficient in eighth grade reading. So, that's got huge implications, for everything that happens, from ninth grade on. So the data is very, very concerning.
Now, in recent years here in New York State, officials, including the governor and state lawmakers, have put a focus on the science of reading, particularly for early learners. As I understand it, one of the recommendations in this report as well is supporting science of reading approaches for adolescents as well. What can you tell me about that, and what does that actually look like?
Yeah, so the state has begun to invest in the science of reading, although we'll say we're one of the last states to do it. And the investments so far have been, very, very small for the size of the state of New York. So we have a lot more to do even on the early literacy side. But yes, very little attention has been focused on the needs of adolescent learners. So what we're asking the state and districts, one is we need to do a better job providing support to secondary educators. Right, many secondary educators were never taught how to teach reading, so we need to do a better job of training them, giving them some of those skills to work with students that are struggling. We need to hire literacy coaches across the state that have expertise in working with adolescent learners. We need to expand the use of assessments that can diagnose students that have challenges with reading and do more screening. We also need to do a way better job in our educator preparation programs, right? So even at the elementary level, we have way too many teacher preparation programs that are not teaching teachers how to use the science of reading in the classroom. And that's also true, again, with adolescent learning. And then finally, we need to build state capacity, you know, and accountability to work on these issues and provide support to districts. Right now, the state is doing very little around adolescent literacy. So we see, you know, some opportunities, particularly to build this into some of the changes the state is making around graduation measures. You know, again, making sure that we give sort of a full out press and identify the kids that need help and then get them the evidence-based support they need.
And lastly, Jeff, are there any districts around New York State that are helping to boost adolescent literacy rates? Are there any districts that come to your mind of that are doing it the right way?
Yeah, so we call out a few examples in the report. New York City Public Schools is really a leader on literacy, and so they have adopted the science of reading in their elementary schools across the district and now are starting to bring that into middle schools. And so they've also been, you know, focused on trying to help educators who, right, support those students with reading. So I think New York City is one to really watch. We also highlight a program in Geneva, which is in upstate New York, where they actually did daily small group reading interventions for students that were struggling and saw a pretty big increase in state ELA proficiency. So there are some examples, and we're going to be doing more work on, you know, lifting up examples from across the state and really across the nation. But this is an opportunity for New York to lead on this issue. You know, I mentioned we're way behind when it comes to early literacy, but states have not really addressed this issue of adolescent literacy full on. And so we think there's an opportunity for New York, again, both at the district level and the state level, to really, really play a leadership role and lean on, you know, we've got some great partners across the state with expertise in this issue. So really trying to leverage what we have, and but most importantly, giving kids what they need.
Jeff Smink is Deputy Director of EdTrust New York. I'm Lucas Willard. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. A new museum in Queensbury, New York, aims to draw pinball wizards and machine tinkerers alike. WAMC's Aaron Shellow Levine reports.
The echoes of arcade game history fill the otherwise quiet Aviation Mall. They're coming from arcade archaeology. The Pinball and Arcade Game Museum held its soft opening late last month. Decades of pinball history lined the walls with dozens of machines with themes ranging from South Park to The Big Lebowski. And Michael Jordan's Space Jam. For proprietor Lonnie Linen, opening the collection of machines to the public has been a long time coming. His father died when Linen was a teenager, and while his dad was never into pinball, Linen credits his dad for his own passion for tinkering and his desire to found the arcade.
Dad, he was a plumber steam fitter. He was an iron worker. He was very much mechanically inclined. And he always wanted me to just be my own individual.
Linen has undoubtedly followed that advice, and it's allowed him to weather all the difficulties that can accompany life's pursuits, including coping with poor weather that delayed the museum's soft opening. Rain can make it challenging to move the expensive, heavy, water-sensitive machines that Linen has spent years collecting.
The long and the short of it is that I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted to have a space where we can focus on nothing but classic games without the limitations of, you know, making money is your big problem, right? A lot of time is that's why a lot of these redemption arcades exist, is it's all about tickets, it's all about prizes. I feel like there's no place to play classic games like this.
Linen says in an era of phone-driven dopamine addictions, there's a market for an analog fix as arcades pop up across the country.
I mean, how can you not like pinball? It's awesome.
He adds it wouldn't have been possible without the help of the pinball community. Several visitors were on hand during Arcade Archaeology's soft opening. Howard Levine helps run Project Pinball, a nonprofit that has donated and maintained more than 80 pinball machines at children's hospitals across the country. Levine says it would be hard to find a more supportive community.
No matter what walk of life they're coming from, no matter what their like financial status, Pinball is just something that brings people together, and you know, we pretty much leave our troubles at the door, leave politics at the door. We're just here to play pinball, to help each other. One of the most amazing things I find about the pinball community is that top players, they share like their success or strategies on the different games.
Alice Brusso has only been competitively pinballing, or pinballing at all, since April. Brusso, who identifies as transgender and non-binary, has been welcomed by the community.
So I entered a tournament at a place in Troy called Mean Max. It's on River Street, and they have some pinball machines there. It was a women's tournament, and the community was really inviting, so I had a blast there. And then that kind of snowballed into playing, you know, every weekend, essentially, sometimes after work, and playing as much as possible.
For those who choose to take the arcade game seriously, Brusso says pinball tournaments are a welcoming space.
In competitive sports in general, sometimes there's contention around trans, non-binary players or competitors. Pinball doesn't have that.
A few machines down from Brusso, a young pinball fanatic is playing one of the museum's older offerings.
I'm Gabriel Giulio, also known as First Prototype, on a few social media pages.
Giulio and his family came from New Jersey for the show.
I think I've played over 900. I'm slowly closing in on 1,000 different machines played. Some of them I've played on virtual machines, like on my iPhone or my iPad or even PlayStation. But most of them I've played on a physical machine, like the one you're watching me play right here.
As far as his pinball ambitions,
I mean, I'm kind of a pro. My freeware initials is PRO, pro, short for First Prototype. Because I'm going to be honest, I'm kind of getting to a pro. Still not quite fair in tournaments yet, but I kind of want to win one soon.
For his mom, Izzy Giulio, the increase in arcade spaces is a win.
For a very long time, you were seeing our arcades close down. Now we're seeing a number of arcades open up in our area, not just up here in the Northeast, but you know, globally within the United States as well as around the world. There is a resurgence. People want to be in those spaces, want to have those community spaces, and they really do gravitate towards those retro games.
Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Shello-Levine for WAMC News.
This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1813. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.